I'm gonna go ahead and call this meeting to order. It is Wednesday, January 19th, 2022. I just want to say right off the bat that we have a very full agenda, very meaty topics. If we get hung up on anything, I am going to table any particular topic for the next meeting, because we do have a lot to get through tonight. So with that, I'm going to turn it right over to Greg Geist. Unmute, please, Greg. There you go.
Thanks, everyone. Good to see you. And I was for some reason under the impression that we started at 6:30 and had just a moment of panic at exactly 6 o'clock. So my apologies for that. And I also agree we have a very meaty agenda. I intended to talk about kind of the vision forward for WES. I mean, this is our year of looking forward, and hopefully you got that from the email that I sent. So I'm going to go ahead and forego that tonight. I did want to talk about the 2022 schedule. I see Renee Harbers in the room, and glad to see that. We are proposing to go to typically the third Wednesday of the month. And some may vary a little bit, and then do 6 to 8, and remain virtual until the COVID situation changes. So, Lauren, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that covers it. As long as everyone's good with that and there's no major conflicts, mostly with the third Wednesdays of the month, we'll go ahead and get the rest of the invites out.
Yeah, sounds good.
We have a very city commission meeting for Oregon City on the first and third Wednesdays. So if it's a subject that I need to be involved in, I may have to skip part of the meetings.
Okay. Yeah, it was a very delicate dance with, you know, the elected folks and the people, civically engaged folks that attend various meetings, regular scheduled meetings. So I think we found the sweet spot, and that's what we're going to go with. As far as I&I update, I see Brian Johnson on the line. We had Johnson City last night. I was there, and they signed the inflow and infiltration intergovernmental agreement, the first city to do so. It's on Oregon City's agenda, consent agenda tonight. And so, Chris, we did move some of the agenda items around so that Chris can peel off and attend the Oregon City meeting in case they have questions for Wes. And I'm set to go to Happy Valley on February 1st to have them hopefully sign the IGA as well. I would say Gladstone and Milwaukee are up next, and hopefully we can get those tackled in the next few weeks. I think we have some more work to do with Wes Lynn, in particular, the public works director, and getting a better technical understanding of what we're doing. So hopefully we can bring Wes Lynn on board shortly as well. So those are my only opening remarks, and let's dive right into it.
Okay, well, with that transition, good evening, everybody. Welcome, and thank you for joining us tonight for the advisory committee, and we appreciate Chair Helms' willingness to let us shuffle the schedule a little bit. This is a topic that we want to present to you, really trying to get the committee's feedback on some of the, you might say, major issues that Wes is going to be trying to integrate across several different sort of categories of conversations. So that's the start of that. Next slide. So what we're trying to pull together is how do all the pieces fit from a financial and sort of execution standpoint. So we'll cover Wes's finances, where we are, just to make sure everyone's starting from the same factual standpoint. Talk about our goals, where we're trying to achieve it. Go over some rate making about how we go about setting our rates, which is a pretty crucial component of the conversation. Talk through some projections, and then ultimately offer a recommendation. This is not for a vote tonight. We wanted to present the ideas, have a chance for you to ask questions, think about it a little bit, see if you have additional information you'd like to see, and then we'll be coming back to you at the next meeting to seek your recommendation about how to proceed. Next slide. To give you a quick summary, and I presume most of you have seen this, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, WES brings in just shy of $42 million in rate revenue, an additional nearly $7 million in SDC revenue. Of that, we only spend $24 million on our operating budget, which includes labor, electricity, chemicals, supplies, studies, all those pieces. We also have a pretty significant debt service component. We have borrowed money in the past to construct facilities. A significant portion of that is eligible for SDCs. And if you recall, this advisory committee gave us authority and direction to utilize SDCs for debt service payments. That was a previous conversation we had. So we're now at the point where we can nearly use the it's 100% of the revenue that comes in, goes back out the door to support debt service, which is a nice way to make sure we are expending those SDC funds in a meaningful and timely fashion. And then the money that's left over after we do that, we are transferring to support capital projects, around $15 million a year, which sounds like a ton.
Chris?
Yes.
Excuse me. You just said 100% is going out and whatever's left over. What can be left over after 100% is gone?
Well, not all the debt service is eligible for SDC payments. So what we're doing is we're collecting the SDCs, and 100% of the money that comes in is used towards the SDC eligible portion. And we actually have a pretty substantial balance of SDCs that have built up over time. So we're trying to draw down that reserve to make sure we're expending
sure.
those SDC funds. But the leftover is after we pay for the operating budget, after we pay for the debt service, minus the portion that the SDC can support. We still have more money coming in than we're expending from the rate revenue side of things. And we're taking that money and transferring it into the capital construction fund to support.
Because we can't use it on debt service?
Well, we do. We pay the whole amount. We pay 100% of the debt service. So I'm making a distinction. Their debt service is bigger than what is SDC eligible. So I'm looking at total revenue that comes in. We minus out our operating budget, what we pay for our debt service, and then whatever is left over from the rate revenue, we are transferring to support capital projects.
Okay.
And I'm emphasizing that that's a lot of money. We're actually generating a pretty good transfer annually into capital expenditures. However, and we've been talking about this for a little while, we're spending more than we're transferring over on a fairly regular basis. This year, we have a budget of $23 million of capital expenditures, and that's low. From what we anticipate, this is sort of I think Lynn has referred to it as a planning year, where we're sort of finishing off some projects and starting up next wave of projects. We expect that number to go higher. So in any given year upcoming, WES is spending more than it brings in. And that's the real rub of the issue that we wanted to highlight to you and make sure that we were talking through the implications of as we go forward. Next slide. So while we're thinking about what we do over the next X number of years about that, we first have to make sure that we're meeting our goals. You, our ratepayers, have specific objectives for us. The first is to make sure we are protecting public health and the environment. So we're going to do what we need to operate the treatment plants. We're going to make sure Greg Ierley has the tools he needs to support our compliance with the Clean Water Act. We're also making sure that we can support economic development, that there's going to be no moratoriums while we are constructing facilities or making sure we have services available. And I'm ranking these, you might say, in order of priority. First, we make sure that we are protecting public health and the environment. Then we make sure that we can meet the demands of economic development. We do so in the most cost-effective manner possible. So we are trying to be efficient with the money that's being brought in. In doing all that, we are also trying to make sure we honor the commitments that we made at the formation of WES, which includes the legacy debt, which you may recall CCSD1, when it was a separate entity, had issued debt to construct facilities to support its wastewater treatment. That debt is the responsibility for just the ratepayers of CCSD 1, which we now call rate zone 2. So there is an element in our rates where folks that live in that area, which includes Milwaukee, Happy Valley, Johnson City, and the unincorporated area, pay for that debt that was theirs, I might say, when they came to the consolidation of the entities. And we also have the ultimate goal that you gave us about a year and a half ago to achieve eventually a rate by service, not by geography standpoint, which is to say, if someone is flushing their toilet and it goes into the wastewater treatment system for wholesale treatment, you pay the same, whether you're in Milwaukee or Oregon City or Westland. Next slide. So I'm now going to ask Aaron to jump in here and talk about some of the objectives we use when we are doing our rate making.
Hey, thanks, Chris. So these next few slides are kind of educational in nature and just serve to provide a broad overview of the rate making process that WES and many other utilities use. So as a financially independent utility, WES's rate setting process is cost-based, just meaning that rates are set based on the cost to provide the service, including all operating and maintenance and capital costs. Under this methodology, our key objectives are full cost recovery in an equitable manner while maintaining revenue and rate stability and predictability. Our 10-year financial planning model incorporates our rate setting strategy and rate making model. The 10-year model is updated in conjunction with our budget, with each year's budget being used as year one in the model. Next slide, please. So cost-based rate making is essentially a three-part analysis that builds, each step builds on each other. The first step is a revenue requirement analysis. During that step, the total revenue requirements for each fiscal year are calculated, and that includes all costs of operating capital, reserves, debt service requirements, and cost to maintain the system. The building blocks of this first analysis are WES's annual operating budget, our five-year CIP and an extended CIP that covers the full 10-year planning cycle, as well as anticipated debt service requirements for both existing and any new debt that we would need to cover capital projects. The second step, or the second analysis, is a cost of service analysis. And that analysis assigns costs to each rate component based on the specific rate component that the costs support. The second part of the analysis also entails calculating the estimated service demands based on population projections. And then finally, the third analysis is a rate design analysis, where we take the total revenue requirements for each particular service, and we calculate the specific rates based on anticipated demands, and then analyze the impact on customer bills and our long-term financial stability. At that point, we also can fine-tune the rates to level out any spikes, and then smooth the rates over the 10-year planning horizon. And next slide, please. And then these are just the three components of WES's sanitary sewer rates, as Chris discussed in a prior slide. Wastewater treatment applies to all sanitary sewer customers in WES. The local collection component applies just to those customers in the city of Happy Valley and unincorporated areas. Customers that reside in other cities are served by the cities that they reside in for the collection component. And then finally, the legacy debt service fee component applies to rate zone 2 only, as Chris shared. And I'll hand it back over to Chris.
Thank you, Erin. Next slide. So we bring that background to you to remind you of the conversations we have every year around budget time, where we show you a rate breakdown. We often show you a bar graph that shows the different components of where it's going and how it's broken down. We're going through a consistent exercise of projecting that out over 10 years. Because one of the other directives we receive from you is to have a nice, smooth rate curve that is at least inflation, but less than 10% that meets all of the goals that you gave us. So we're trying to make sure we can achieve that objective. One of the challenges that we're looking at over time is, frankly, growth in labor costs. WES is a little bit more fortunate than many government entities compared to schools, for example, in that our operating budget for labor is around half of what we expend. Often you will see in some government entities, public service and employees are 80 to 90% of the budget. I will note we're seeing inflationary pressures on a lot of our costs. So part of what our objective is to figure out what we can afford, when we can afford it, and maintain those key objectives. We're anticipating increases in our operating expenses, which is going to decrease the amount that we can contribute towards capital projects. Each year when I talk about that, whatever's left over, when there's more that we have to spend on the operating budget, there's less that is left over. And as we borrow money, that goes to debt service, which is also less that is left over. There's sort of a cycle that happens there. So, next slide. What we are looking at from a capital planning standpoint, and Lynn has presented different sort of areas around this and is going to be, I think, also sharing more around this later, is a fairly robust capital improvement plan that requires a fair amount of expenditures, again, more than what we are transferring on an annual basis. And it's refined constantly as we get better information, we get actual bids for what the project cost will be. And what we're trying to do is establish a financial plan that allows us to accomplish what we need to accomplish while being mindful of the impacts on rates and our ability to support the operating budget. So this has been something of an internal conversation that we've had, trying to ensure sequencing is appropriate, ensure that we're able to meet our objectives and we're able to do so affordably for our ratepayers. Next slide. Happily, I can say there's no squeeze or emergency. This is us, to sort of reemphasize what Greg was talking about, planning ahead and looking forward and thinking about the future. Wes has sizable reserves right now, and although we are spending more than we are saving, you might say, we've saved quite a bit before this that allows us to smooth the curve. So we have substantial reserves to support capital projects. However, we are estimating that we will spend all that money in the next 5 years if we maintain the pace of our capital program. So we're going to start assuming, we assume from our projections on that path that we will start borrowing money every year to afford the capital program beginning in 26, 27. And there's sort of that cycle that pops up again. The more you borrow, the less you have you can save each year because you're spending it on debt service rather than putting it in your savings account for capital costs. And the next year you have to borrow more because you saved less, et cetera, et cetera. So we've actually assumed we're going to get down to having $3 million in the bank rather than over $100 million, which is where we are right now. We will be looking at other options. In particular, there's a couple federal programs that are linked to state revolving fund loans that may not only be loans, but also potentially grants. So we're going to continue to watch and try to squeeze every dollar we can to avoid cost to the ratepayers. But we are going to be spending money. Next slide. So where does that take us? What's the conversation that we're looking to happen? I wanted to remind everyone, as I mentioned before, that we have a direction around a rate profile. Inflation to a maximum of 10%, and frankly, we want to come in on the lower end of that profile. The committee recognized the value of using SDCs, which has increased our financial flexibility. It frankly has allowed us to shift more money into the capital construction account and expend those SDCs. We are looking, therefore, if we can hit that target of having capital expenditures of around $33 million a year at 5% rate adjustments per year. Again, with assuming the labor costs are going up 6 to 7%, assuming we're going to have to borrow every year in the out years, those sorts of factors, we think we can manage that financially with a 5% per year increase, which is to say a pretty steady tick above inflation, but not that much above inflation as we go along.
Chris,
I'm sorry, go ahead, William.
Excuse me. Yeah, it was my recollection that it wasn't, the minimum of inflation, the definition of inflation, wasn't there an index that we pegged that to?
Yes. It was the Engineering News Record. Aaron was the was the publication group was from?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's ENR. I'm not remembering the acronym. Engineering News Record, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, and that's what we're using for a definition of inflation.
Correct. It's tied primarily to capital expenditures, not, you know, annual expenditures like electricity or chemicals.
Yeah, I just think it's important for us to be clear on what we mean by inflation in our communications with the public.
Very true. That's a good point. And we chose that because we thought the capital expenditures would be the primary driver of impact on the budget. And as you can see, with the CIP, in essence, targeted slash capped at $33 million a year, that is the single largest expenditure that we make each fiscal year is around capital projects. So that's the idea behind it. What that means is the 5% presumes a certain level of inflation. And we actually assumed a relatively high cost inflators for some stuff because this is the best model that we can make it. And frankly, we're seeing some indications that there's going to be significant cost pressures on multiple areas for at least a couple of years. I have to say, thank you, Advisory Committee, because we went out and borrowed money last February. You may recall, even though we had $100 million in the bank, we went and borrowed money at 0.8% interest.
Yeah.
That money is saving us money right now. So thank you.
Practically free.
Yep. Thank you for your foresight and support for that move because it's definitely saving us money.
Chris, can I ask a quick question? When we did this, and I know that we talked about this a couple of years ago, COVID was not part of the picture. And with the an increase in materials, and I think that we got the new digester done before that, thankfully, but have we then taken into account what prices have gone up and people talk about them coming down, but my experience has been prices go up and stay up because people will pay them. So do we need to relook at this to include those inflated numbers from what's happened due to COVID?
That is a great question. And what Lynn has been doing with the capital improvement plan, she iterates it every year and she's watching the prices very closely. We've seen some of our projects increase in price significantly. And we built those revised numbers into the capital improvement plan projections, which are then going through the rate making model that Aaron walked us through. So each year we're trying to refine it. I would say the numbers that we're talking about right now as sort of a baseline incorporate a fair amount of that, but I don't think we found all the landmines that are out there, honestly.
Yeah.
Sorry, Lynn, do you have anything to add on that?
No, I'll just say that Chris is right. We refine every year as we do more work on projects. Things come into focus as to what we're going to be building and we can refine the costs. We do build in to midpoint of construction on our estimates. And it's just right now things are pretty volatile. So we're just sitting back and watching other projects. The ODOT project will be interesting. And people are being creative, and I know ODOT is in building in some flexibility for the contractors so they don't have to try to predict out 5 years. So we're all just trying to feel our way through this.
Okay.
Yeah. A concern that I have, Diana, is that it's not just the cost of materials. It's the lags in the supply chains that are driving me crazy and everyone else that I know of, that the materials just can't be moved from point A to point B with any reliability. And that's got to impact our costs.
It does. I will note that Lynn has noted in the past, we're really fortunate in that we already had a hard bid before COVID hit for the solids handling project.
Yeah.
And we have not yet launched hard bids for our upcoming projects. So we're kind of riding the wave right now and watching the numbers and trying to plan appropriately. But we haven't got locked into it on a couple of the big projects that we know that are upcoming. And we're hopeful that some of these lags, kinks, gaps get smoothed out enough where we don't see the continued acceleration, or frankly, the real problem is just lack of availability for some of the key components or supplies.
Yeah.
Which they see no end to for the next couple of years, right? Right. It's very discouraging, right?
It really is. I do know Lynn goes through a process, and Lynn, if you can talk about this more, that would be great, of identifying long lead time pieces of equipment or items, and we often will order them 18 months in advance because we know that they need to show up at a certain point, and that's built into the schedule for project as well.
Right, we're waiting for one more garage door, roll-up door for the Tri-City Solids project. They just keep putting us off, so that's kind of funny. But we had everything else here for that project, and we'll just continue to see, you know, lead times are long. On the outfall, we'll be strategically thinking about when we need to order the pipe to get it here in time, for example.
Very good. Carry on.
Question about that as well. Good evening, everyone. Roseanne with HBA. I am curious, Lynn, planning ahead like that, you know, obviously very wise. I am curious, though, with the ARPA money that's slated to come in for a bunch of infrastructure projects, probably. What is that going to do to not only to inflation, but also to additional lead times? Because people or entities will think, or will entities think, okay, I'm going to get this money, and so I'm going to order it. So you're going to have an increase in orders as well? Question mark.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I will say that what we do know about some of the federal money is that it has a even higher threshold of Buy American requirements in it. And that's causing some problems because we don't have the domestic capability of producing some of these goods. It's always brought in from elsewhere, and we just don't have the capacity for some of that. So we're in a planning year, thankfully, and we're just sitting back and kind of waiting to see. But we'll be doing, you know, where we've got Buy American for steel, for example, maybe we use that money for a project that won't require a lot of steel, you know, concrete pipe or something like that. So we're trying to work with all the puzzle pieces.
And a lot of the problem with that too is that even the Made in America stuff, a lot of them source the parts for what they're making out of other countries. So it might be made here, but they have 90% of the parts, but that last 10% is on a container ship, you know, in LA. So it's very hard.
And the percentage of parts that have to be made in the US is higher too. That's a problem.
Right.
And when we noted earlier that we would be looking at SRF loans, which is the state revolving fund loans, which is the primary mechanism for a lot of those ARPA dollars coming out of the federal government into the state, our industry, I will say. Part of the challenge of that is a lot of the arbitrage rules apply in the exact same way, which is to say, if you borrow the money, you have to spend it or have a really good plan to spend it within 3 years. So you can't just borrow and sit on the cash. But we're still looking at it because we've actually, if you recall, we did use an SRF loan for the solids handling project because we were able to get money in lieu of paying additional interest. We had a certified project that was available, the Three Creeks project. So we were able to lower our interest rate to 1% on the SRF and then move about $1.6 million over to support the Three Creeks project. If we can tap into some of those stimulus dollars, or we can get some other similar synergistic opportunities to support surface water projects, that's still a viable strategy. But here we're sort of getting bit a little bit by having that $40 million in the bank, because we've got to spend that in the next 3 years. So we want to make sure we do that and comply with our bond covenants. So there's a bit of a dance there. But overall, what you're seeing is in some ways a trade-off on both rates and capital. I think Lynn would love to go faster and build more. I think our ops folks would like to have that conversation too, to a certain extent. From a rate profile standpoint, of course, Aaron and I are over here saying, why don't we just do inflation? Let's try and keep the rates as low as possible. And Greg is kind of in the middle listening to everybody saying, what's a great landing spot where we can make sure we're meeting our objectives, but we're not stressing our ratepayers.
Right.
And some of those internal compromises led to this recommendation that you see before you. Next slide. So I did want to highlight some components to this because the 5% is on the wholesale wastewater service rate. That's the majority of our capital expenditures. When Aaron was talking about how some retail customers are billed directly by WES, others are billed by the cities that they live in, those rates will be somewhat independent, especially if you're in a city that is doing their own work. We're hoping they're also raising rates to support that I&I work and working to improve their system, their collection system. We are looking at moderate rate increases on the retail side. However, there's a corollary that happens as why we share the rate, the process of generating rates is because we have that legacy debt component that's part of rate zone two. We are seeing greater than expected growth in rate zone two. You may recall we've had this projection from about 5 years ago that looked at overall we should be adding around 800 to up to 1,000 equivalent dwelling units per year. And that was spread across all cities, all rate zones. We are hitting about that number, but it's not showing up where we thought it would. There is greater than expected growth in Happy Valley and the unincorporated area. There is less than expected growth happening in rate zone one, particularly Oregon City, which was where we thought, because of zoning availability, where the majority of growth on the south side would occur. So more growth is happening in the area that pays for the legacy debt. And we're also getting more SDC revenue related to that in that zone. And we're applying it to that legacy debt payment. So while the 5% rate increase will be happening on the wholesale side, we'll actually be lowering the retail side. So the net rate increase for folks in rate zone two will be different than it will be in rate zone one. The folks that just pay wholesale will see a 5% rate increase. The folks that pay wholesale and retail will see a percent increase that is probably much lower than that, on the order of 1% to 2%, depending on where the growth profiles come in. Because we want to honor the commitment that the folks in rate zone two will be the only people that pay for that debt. But by the way, if you're doing a great job paying that debt, we're not going to charge you extra, right? So we're seeing more growth, we're seeing a little bit more revenue, we are decreasing the amount that we need to charge for the legacy debt year over year. The happy coverage of that response or consequence of that is that in about 10 years, when the legacy debt is paid off, everyone will have rates that will be virtually identical, and you will be paying for the service you receive, and it will not be based on you. So we believe that this approach is consistent with the direction we received from the advisory committee previously on multiple fronts, but it's a somewhat politically sensitive topic. We're talking long-term rate increases are going to happen. We're talking long-term structuring and capital plan that you might say smooths out and delays in some instances some capital projects, so the timing of the expenditures works to maintain that financial profile. So we wanted to present this to you and get your feedback on it, your thoughts, and then be able to build that into the final recommendation that would go to the Board of County Commissioners and then be integrated into our budget proposals that you would see in May. And I believe that is the last slide, is it not? No, I covered all this. I forgot it was right there. So there we go. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes for questions before we move to the next topic, the financial policies topic. Anyone have any questions?
Good work, Chris.
No.
I have a question. I didn't hear you address the point about our losing our AAA rating. Is that going to happen regardless, or do you anticipate that happening regardless what we do with rates?
Well, you might say it's going to happen unless we are super aggressive in raising rates. Probably, for lack of a better term, I will use a financial sort of axiom that you'll hear. The people that can best borrow money are the people that least need it, which is to say the best people that are credit risk are the people that don't, that have such an ability to repay that you are 100% sure they'll get it. Right now, when credit rating agencies are reviewing us, they're like, you want to borrow $40 million? How come, oh wait, you have $100 million in the bank. I feel comfortable that you will be able to repay this. But if we follow our plan of spending this down and we get to the point where we have $3 million in the bank, when we go to borrow the money, they're going to be less gracious in viewing our ability to repay, which means we are presuming that our rating is going to go down and our interest rates are going to tick up a little bit from what we can get. The only way to avoid that would be to generate a really high coverage ratio, is what it's called, that your ability to pay the debt service is a multiple of the revenue that's coming in. And to do that, we would have to charge rates that would be 9-10% a year rate increases. Mm-hmm. And we're not recommending that. We would rather just pay a little bit higher interest rates on the debt than we would to try and
what we today. Will have, Chris, as time progresses, is we will have history. We will have a track record of being responsible stewards of those borrowed monies. And we'll be able to use that, I think, to our advantage in arguing for better rates.
Yeah, I think we will stay in a premium grade for our ratings. I don't think we will drop down too much. AAA is the best you can possibly be. So we just have an extraordinarily high rating, which is a testament to the great financial management of the organization over the years. But we know that we've managed it well to be able to do things. And our emphasis is supporting operations and building the things that we need to make sure that we can accomplish what we need to accomplish. If that means we drop down, that's okay. But that's a good question. Thank you for reminding me of saying that, Renee. I appreciate it.
Anyone else? All right, this ties right into the financial policies discussion. So we changed the agenda to move right into that. So Aaron and Chris will follow it up.
Indeed, and at this point, actually, I'm going to say thank you for your attention. And Aaron is going to have this entire presentation by herself, and I will circle back with the group. If you have any questions, feel free to just email, call, and we will be happy to address them. And we will bring this back to you at the next meeting for a vote.
Thank you, Chris. Good luck at your meeting.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Okay, so we first shared these financial policies for input at the November meeting, and we're sharing again this evening for additional dialogue and to request that the committee vote on moving forward a recommendation for their adoption. In this evening's presentation, we'll provide some brief background on the project, and then focus on key attributes of the proposed policies, including the objectives, impact, differences from our current policies, answers to questions from the November meeting, and conclude with next steps and a request for the motion. Next slide, please. To offer some background on why we embarked in this project, financial policies are really a cornerstone in public financial management. They're critical for establishing the structure for decision-making and financial planning processes, ensuring financial transparency, resiliency, and supporting strong bond ratings that we were just discussing. Our best practices recommend a periodic review and updates to policies to ensure that they continue to align with a business's needs. The county started a periodic review of general county policies last year, some of which hadn't been updated since 2004. And this is giving us an opportunity to update WES-specific policies as well. The three policies that we'll be going over tonight not only align with the county's updates, they also reflect WES's unique business needs and utility management best practices. And the timing of this update is especially fortuitous because it allows us to incorporate any changes into next fiscal year's budget and our 10-year financial forecast. Next slide, please. The operating reserve policies are often considered to be the most important policy an organization can have. They're super important for bond ratings. They're one of the key factors in determining WES's recent AAA rating was our strong reserves. And they're also important to ensure that we have continuity of operations in response to unforeseen events such as those that we've experienced in the last 2 years. Reserves can also be leveraged to level out rate increases over a long-term planning horizon. So there's a lot of uses for reserves, a lot of many purposes to have a strong reserve policy. Under the county's current budget and financial planning policies, our reserve consists of just a budgeted contingency of 60 days, and that's 60 days equal to annual budgeted operating expenses. That's not in sync with our long-range plan, which uses fixed $3 million for the sanitary sewer model and $1.5 million for the surface water reserve, which is closer to 90 days for surface water and 45 days for sewer. The proposed reserve policy establishes a 60-day target for both the budget and long-range plan, so that brings those two into sync. It also gives us an option to use a combination of just a budgeted contingency or a budgeted contingency and a designated reserve line item. Just to go back to the 60 days target for a second, we based that on both the county's recommended reserve for enterprise funds and best practices as recommended by other organizations, including NACWA and the Government Finance Officers Association. We also considered WES's historic contingency use. We don't often need to access the contingency through the budget year, and the characteristics of our cash flow for operations, such as our billing cycle and our receivables balances. The proposed policy also gives us an option to set up a rate stabilization account. At this point, it's an option only, and we would come back to this committee for input before moving forward with that, but that would be an option for us in case we were looking forward 5 years into the financial plan and we felt like we needed another option to ensure that we were going to meet debt coverage requirements. And whether we use a budgeted contingency or a designated reserve to access either would require board action. Access to a contingency would be during the budget cycle in response to unforeseen events such as a chemical shortage. Access to the designated reserve would be during the budget planning cycle, so before the budget year kicked off, and that would be with request to access that from this committee and the board. And then this operating reserve policy is expected to have minimal impact, as we're anticipating we can fund it with net revenue surplus from prior fiscal years. It will have some minor, very minor impact in future years on the how soon we'll need to borrow funds, and that's a matter of months, not years. So we just, as we'll be diverting some money into the reserve fund that would have been available for capital projects if we were continuing to fix that reserve on the sanitary side at $3 million rather than to scale it with each year's budgeted operating expenses. And then this also achieves alignment between our budget and long-range financial planning models and ensures that we have some mitigation of operational risk in response to what we've seen can happen in the last year. Are there any questions on this before we move to the next slide? Yes, William.
Yeah, excuse me, Erin. And I just need to mention this one more time. I've mentioned it before, and I don't think that there's anything that we can do differently about it, but maybe it's just personal with me, but the term 60 days, I still find a little fuzzy because 60 days are different because we have cyclic needs for our expenditures and cyclic times when our revenue is available, that 60 days, 60-day average of an entire fiscal year, is that correct?
Yes, and I am so glad you brought that up, because Lauren, if you'll go to the next slide, please. So at the November meeting, William, you had asked the excellent question, which 60 days? Like, is there a seasonality to our expenses? And we said we suspect that our operating cash disbursements are relatively even because they're primarily payroll, which is pretty consistent throughout the year, but that we would do an analysis and come back to you with the answer to that question. And so this slide is the answer to that question. We did a 10-year look back of 60-day rolling operating cash disbursements. And so that's 60 days starting on July 1st, July 2nd, July 3rd, and taking the total cash disbursements for each 60-day period within a fiscal year. The chart on this slide is representative of all of the other 9 years that we looked at. And that green line in the middle is the 60 days average contingency, so where we would be setting the reserve target. And then the blue line is our actual rolling cash disbursements. And you can see for the most part, the cash disbursements are below that green line. So the average 60 days contingency would be sufficient, with the exception of one a time around a particularly large transfer to the county. So we are currently billed on a single bill for all expenses allocated to us for services provided by other county departments, things such as technology services, payroll, HR, county administration, and then we pay for that with a single transfer in January of each calendar year, and that's that arrow on the chart, and you can see that that spikes our 60-day rolling cash disbursements to where it's above that 60-day contingency line. So this was an excellent question because it gave us a unique view of our cash disbursements. And I also love any question that you can answer partially with a chart. So yeah.
I figured you were going to be ready for us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was actually a lot of fun. So given the fact that we have some control, because this is a related party transaction, and that's really the only thing that's pushing us above that average 60 days contingency, we do think the target of 60 days average is appropriate, and we would recommend moving forward with that. But we are going to explore some alternate methods of paying for our county allocated costs. They don't necessarily have to be in a lump sum. We could potentially spread that out if we were looking at cash flow and wanted to even that out. So anyway, one more thing about this slide that is kind of interesting. You can see it has sort of a regular nature to it. It's got those little spikes. So that's because we do payroll on a biweekly basis, and some 60 days have 4 payrolls and some have 5. This gave us a lot to think about. So thank you, William.
That's a great chart. Thanks for being prepared.
Yeah, absolutely. Any other questions about operating reserves before we move on? Oh, Renee.
Yes. I hesitate asking this because I frankly can't even imagine a situation where this would come up. But I wonder, in the case of some kind of catastrophic emergency and needing to go to the board for approval, can you imagine any scenario where that would be a limitation, where WES would need to operate more quickly if they're unable to connect with the board, if, you know, phone lines are down and et cetera, et cetera? Or does some kind of special emergency policy kick in a case like that?
Well, so are you thinking in terms of accessing that contingency?
Yes, being able to access the money if you're unable to get board approval for some reason.
Yes, there is a statutory allowance for us. If it was, let's say that we designated some of the 60 days target as a reserve as opposed to a contingency, thereby making it a little bit more challenging to access during the course of the budget year. If there's an extreme situation like the one you were just outlining, we could access that reserve. So that wouldn't be locked up in that sort of situation. 60 days gives us quite a bit of flexibility to respond to unforeseen events. We weathered the storm and the fires and the pandemic in the last 2 years without having to access contingencies. So we feel that 60 days would be sufficient, and I think we could access that quickly enough in the event of something happening, where either a contingency or a reserve would be workable. But Greg, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Oh, no, I was just going to ask if that was like a force majeure clause in the ordinances. I would guess that there is. And so if we have the big one, there's a trapdoor.
Good question, Renee.
Yeah, that was a great question. Anything else? All right, next slide, please. The miscellaneous fee policy that we're proposing is very similar to the current policy. It's proposing full cost recovery. The current policy, however, lacks specificity, and so we have made a few changes to make it more specific to WES and more specific to the business needs of a wastewater utility in general. And those changes include development of an overhead application model where we could consistently and rationally apply overhead to all fees that were being analyzed, periodic review of fees by line of business, and consideration of full cost recovery on a multi-year programmatic basis, as we have some fees that are variable from year to year on the revenue side, but are fairly fixed on the cost side. And so looking at those over a longer term allows us to realize cost recovery without inflating the cost of fees in any one particular year where activity might be lower. And then it's consistent with the guidance that we've received from this committee for our user rates, our user service charges. We're also proposing a potential phased approach for increases to mitigate the impact to customers. And this fee policy achieves, again, increased financial transparency, and it will align more closely with WES's business needs. Any questions on the fee policy? All right, next slide, please. And as was shared in November, WES doesn't currently have a full debt policy. So the county just developed a comprehensive debt policy in the last year, and we took this as an opportunity to develop a comprehensive WES-specific debt policy. There aren't really a lot of changes proposed here. This policy is mostly a codification of best practices and the compliance requirements that were required for both legal and state statutory requirements. We're proposing to continue to operate independently from the county's debt process for both managing and issuing debt. We're proposing to continue to use debt only for capital financing and to structure the debt in such a way that the term of the debt matches the asset's useful lives. And we're proposing to continue with the default type of debt being a revenue obligation or bond sold at competitive auction. And the primary objective with this policy is to ensure increased financial transparency, alignment with the strategies that we're using to ensure stable and predictable rate increases, and to codify our best practices. Are there any questions on this one? All right, next slide, please.
I had a question, Aaron.
Yeah.
The first bullet under the current policy, it says currently no full debt policy.
Yes.
Is that something that will change? You would think that, I would think that you would want a complete debt policy, if I'm understanding what that bullet is getting at.
Yes, thank you. So the proposed policy is a comprehensive or full debt policy. Okay. Currently, we have some, it's a very basic debt policy, but it doesn't cover everything that it needs to cover. So there's, back in November, we discussed there's a bit of a trade-off between flexibility and control and financial policies, and certain policies will emphasize one over the other if there are some very strict statutory requirements. And with debt, we have bond covenants that we need to comply with and statutory requirements, legal and SEC requirements. And so an emphasis of control and being as specific and comprehensive as possible is really important for this type of policy. So yes, that is one of our goals with this policy, is to take it from not really being specific enough, not fully covering WES's debt needs, to comprehensively addressing all of the specifics of issuance, management, and the particulars of the structures. So that was a great question. Thank you.
I have a quick question regarding the financing term matches assets' useful lives. I thought that was very clever to have that in there. I'm wondering how we're determining those assets' useful lives. So I'm imagining that we have some expected use of an asset, and that we don't want to pay for it until it's not worth anything.
Yes.
Or we don't want to continue paying for it if it's not worth anything.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So we want the cost of the asset to be aligned with the parties that benefit from the asset. So matching the debt financing and the responsibility for the repayment of the debt with the asset's useful life allows us to allocate the cost of that asset amongst the ratepayers who benefit from its use. And asset useful lives are, I believe, determined by Lynn. We have an accounting methodology for determining asset useful lives for depreciation purposes, but sure. Lynn has more sophisticated methods for capital planning.
Nice. It was a nice touch. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. So to conclude, we will be finalizing the proposed policies. We would like to request a motion to support the approval and adoption of these policies by the board. If that recommendation is made, we would then present these policies to the Board of County Commissioners for adoption and then proceed with incorporating into next year's budget and our financial planning cycle.
So moved.
Thank you, Aaron.
I'll second.
All right. So we have a motion from William and a second from
Anthony.
Anthony. Thank you, Anthony. Did anyone have any other questions? William jumped right on that. So I just want to make sure there weren't any other questions before we put this out there. All right. So I'm just going to say, if everyone say aye, if you are aye, or I will just say this, if there's anyone opposed, just let me know. It's easier on these screens. All right. I think we're good. Motion carries. And you can move forward. Aaron, that was a great presentation, and I think that was very thoughtful and thorough work on your part, along with Chris, to get that all up to speed. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you for everyone's questions and support.
And ideally, we would be moving into Lynn's Willamette Facilities Plan discussion now, but we actually pushed her to the end because the rules and regulations presentation is going to be it was scheduled for 30 minutes and we switched it to 45 because it's going to be also very meaty and Ron has a lot to go over. And I think there will be questions. A lot of people got their questions answered ahead of time, which I appreciate Ron reaching out and finding out if there were specific things people were concerned about when he sent out this packet. But Ron, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Diana. We get to continue somewhat heavy topics and presenting some policy decisions to you. It's a continuation of conversation we had in November, and your presentation in your packet is essentially the same. Mainly just for you to have and to be able to review and understand and come prepared for this discussion. So I'm probably not going to go through, I can say I'm not going to go through and present all of the slides and all the material again. This is going to be more rapid movement through the first part and get right into the policy discussions so we can have more of you talking this time, less of me talking. I don't have any charts to answer really good questions. I wish I did. That's Aaron's role. So this will be more of a discussion. I don't have those talents that she has. So next slide. So this is what we're after. Again, I will do a brief project background. We will get right into the key policy discussions. And then the recommendation at the end, we'll circle back. We'll be looking for the committee's concurrence with these key policy changes as proposed or modified, and then recommending that we engage the county commissioners in the ordinance adoption process. And you'll see in the slide just sort of on that process, but I just want to flag early on, there is a lot more process. There are many more steps here than moving forward with these policies as proposed, including continuing to prepare documents, policy sessions with our county commissioners, ordinance adoption hearings. We have quite a bit more to go. So there's certainly room for change down the line. Next slide. So again, this is, you know, that one of the overarching reasons we did this project was the formation of the West Partnership and the dealing with the issue that we have, disparate rules and standards among our service districts that we need to consolidate into one set of rules and standards that recognizes and adjusts to the services we provide, but gives us one book to really work from. So that's the overarching goal. Next. And again, just on a process, I always want to reinforce that we started this project with listening. We have not updated our rules and standards for quite some time, comprehensively speaking. And now that we're basically repealing everything and replacing the rules and standards, it's a full rewrite. We wanted to hear from people on what we should really be focusing on from a policy standpoint. So there were quite a few conversations with community groups, task force, internal to our staff, as well as staff from the cities that we serve, moving us through to kind of where we've been stuck a little bit for the past couple of years, partially due to COVID, partially because these types of projects are hard to do in this type of environment, but we've also been doing a lot of work. And so that's our public review drafts that we did in early 2021, West Advisory Committee conversations, and then at the end of the process, the hearings on ordinance adoption. Next slide. And so this is just a reminder of a lot of the conversations we've had, presentations to community groups, like chambers, watershed councils, business alliances. We hosted a forum on the rules and standards back in 2019 as we rolled into 2020, and several conversations with our advisory committee, just project updates, and then specific topical conversations that we've had. Next slide. So this will get us right into the key policy changes. I'll say I heard from about five people that were seeking additional clarification or comment or expressing concern with policies as proposed and helping me flag the highlights for us to discuss tonight. And I'm going to start with those. So we're going to probably bounce around a little bit because I want to make sure that we have enough space to have a discussion about the things people seem most interested in. I can't say that, you know, certainly there isn't, I won't say that there's not interest in our changes to our low income discount policy. We just haven't heard a lot of concern or request for clarification of that proposal. So we might not talk about it tonight. But I want to touch on the highlights, and this is a good place to start. I'll just sort of recast the issue, and that is how we make decisions about annexing properties into the district. We operate from a policy that's not memorialized in our rules and standards. It stems from a conversation with the county commissioners in 2013, and it really it says at the time that in 2013 with the conversation with the county commissioners that WES would not annex properties into the service district without them first annexing into a city that we serve and obtaining WES's services. We're not proposing to change that policy. We're just proposing to fold it into our rules and regulations so it's clearer and more predictable. That change will basically, as written in this section of the rules, just says if it's outside of the current district boundary and not within a city, then they must first seek annexation into the city, and we wouldn't process a petition for annexation until the city has taken action. A part of that is also, as written in the rules, that if the city denies a property access and a property or properties to annex into a city, that West will serve those properties. That statement's probably too general, and something that Greg DiLoretto had pointed out in a conversation with him that really, so I want to just clarify, and then I'll go to Greg because I see your hand up. There's a couple situations where that would happen. And generally speaking, I think overarching, and this is something that we can consider clarifying in the rule language, is that if sanitary sewer service is reasonably available, and there's definitions for that, then WES would likely serve the property if it's not annexed into a city. Those situations are, you can see in within CCSD 1, that there are holes in the district boundary that are well within the urban area, are receiving urban services and have sewer access to them. If the city, for some reason, and we rarely see this, I don't know if we've ever seen it, but if the city were denied annexation into the city, West would serve those properties because service is at their front door. On the edges of cities like Happy Valley and Oregon City that might be rapidly growing, in a lot of those cases, there isn't sewer service available. So if the city denied an annexation into the city, it wouldn't really matter because West couldn't serve them anyway. But we have had situations in Oregon City recently where someone had a failed septic system. They weren't allowed to annex into Oregon City, and they had a sewer main right in front of their house. And we allowed them to connect to the sewer to abate that hazard. So that's sort of a nuance that I think we certainly could clarify in the existing language. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. And I think you've answered it. The issue I have is that it's not clear in the rules. And so it makes it sound like, hey, if the city denies the annexation, we're just going to do it anyway. And right. Then in that case, it begs the question, well, why ask them in the first place? And so my suggestion in the comments I made to you for consideration was we ought to spell out what would constitute us annexing it or serving it if the city denied annexation, so that it's clear that the conversation the city has is important and that it did consider it. But if there's a health hazard, you certainly have to serve that. And that's really the one case that I can see where it's important to do. So I'm just saying in the rules, we need to spell that out so that we understand that we're not just doing this because we can, but there's a reason for doing it.
Right. And I think that's a good suggestion that we could certainly do. To make it clear when that will happen rather than just saying it will happen.
And William hand us up too, Ron.
Yeah, I can't find the little digital hand up, but I guess that works. Yeah, that works. Being from Oregon City and being perhaps too involved in annexation issues, because it used to be that they had to be voted on by citywide, they had some pretty crazy rules. But there are some rules specifically that talk about the ability to annex a piece of property has to be already contiguous with the city boundaries. And it has, so they don't allow islands. So you're not going to have a piece of property floating away from the rest of the city. And I can see that they would deny annexations for that, but I don't know how that's going to help West, because there's no sewer line out to right. islands anyway.
Yeah, we don't see concurrent annexations like we used to. It has to be separate. The cities don't have authority to annex properties into the city boundary and to a special district. They can take them out, but they can't put them in. And so we tend to, in Oregon City and West Lynn, we tend to have more concurrent annexations where we are soon following the annexation into a city, but in Happy Valley, there's some rapid expansion of the city that is out of ways where we see properties annex into the city and they don't annex into the district for quite some time until they actually develop and need sewer service. And you're right, there isn't actually sewer service available. So there's a bit of a discrepancy there.
Okay.
That's an awkward situation. Go ahead.
Yeah.
So, and I don't, maybe David or Michael can help with this, but isn't throughout Happy Valley, aren't there little islands of property that are not annexed into the city because people did not want to annex into Happy Valley? I don't know if those people are on septic still, but if, like, let's say their septic failed and they don't want to annex into the city, but they want sewer service, would they be denied? They would actually be forced to join the city?
So, Diana, I can speak to that. And I forgot what year it was that Ron mentioned, but that was the impetus for that board directive, was that there are these, and you'll see it, there's actually a map in Lynn's presentation later that shows the service district boundaries, and you can clearly see those donut holes.
Yes.
In Happy Valley. And yeah, so that was a direction that the board said is that you know, those donut holes need to annex into the city in order to get our service. So that's what we require.
And I have to ask why. I mean, these people then would have the tax burden of paying additional taxes in addition to the treatment service. So why I don't know. It's almost like a double whammy for someone who's has a financial hardship, I guess.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a decision that the board made. I think, and I don't think David was around back then. Maybe he can, maybe he has some history. I don't know, but that was an agreement that the city and the county made.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, William.
Yeah, and you know, I don't see it as a double whammy, and I don't see it as a hardship. My perspective on it is that you pay taxes being in a city, and you get benefits for those taxes. You get better police protection. You know, you get you have better streets, certainly better than county streets. You have advantages for being in the city. If you choose not to be in the city, you know, if you don't want to be a healthy part of a community, then maybe you don't belong in the community. And that sounds pretty hard-nosed, but I just don't think that it's a tragedy. It bothers me that there are a number of people that choose not to annex into the city when they could easily, and they're the ones that are getting the free ride. I mean, they're getting all sorts of benefits, and they are not paying for them.
I don't disagree with you. I just was wondering I know that there's people who are very set in their ways about not joining a particular city, and just wondered how that was handled. So.
Yeah, we're fortunate in that we get to sort of look at it somewhat myopically for just providing this service to people. And so needing to be in the district in order to provide that service. I will say there's one other nuance where there are some properties that are currently it's sort of in the central parts of our service districts that are actually currently part of the service district, but not connected to sewer. They're in the service district because they were part of the original assessment district in the original formation of the district. When those properties come in for sewer service, we provide them service regardless of whether they annex into a city, because they're already in the district. They have been in the district, and they've already paid their way in. So that is something that we continue to do. We don't see a ton of those anymore, but they are out there occasionally. So that's worth noting as well.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Sure. Any other thoughts or concerns, asks on the annexation piece? This is kind of an important one, so we will certainly clarify our intent. I think, again, we're trying to memorialize or codify what we currently do now. Okay.
Good work.
We can always come back. The next one, Lauren, I was going to say go down to slide 12, but you don't know which one that is. So that's just in my presentation. Can you go down? We're going to skip down to the EDU determinations for residential properties. Next one, back one, big, one more. That's the one. So I talked to some folks a little bit about this, and I think Roseanne had asked that we chat about this one again. Again, this is the sort of tiered approach to assigning equivalent dwelling units to residential properties. It's a policy that the county has already adopted for transportation SDCs. We've received a lot of support for it so far. And I think, I don't know whether, Roseanne, do you want to weigh in on this policy at all?
I want to just reiterate support on behalf of HBA for this policy, because it is really getting at the infrastructure needs for different housing types, and not treating all housing types as exactly the same from an infrastructure perspective. So I think in that regard, it's really a very significant piece of the equity puzzle that we're all trying to solve when it comes to the price of housing and the price, frankly, of infrastructure, right, that we talked about earlier. So having variable rate or tiered rate SDCs for different housing types based on square footage, I think is really avant-garde, and I commend the group for moving it forward.
Great, thank you. Any other thoughts or questions on this one?
Maybe it's
an easy one. Well, it wasn't easy to do, but you know, and we'll see how it goes. Still a lot of process left, but thank you for that. I think you just go down one, Aaron, to the next slide. Next one. That was the only visual I have in my presentation. system development charge financing. Again, Roseanne, we talked about this one a little bit. It's different than deferrals, which is a separate topic, but I'll just run through this one again. We have a current policy that allows for financing of SDCs, but it's really has no limits on types or amounts. It does not specify for the language, doesn't specify residential EDUs or SDCs, which can, you know, if we're out loaning large amounts of cash, and Erin Blue knows more about these implications than I do, because this kind of comes from her shop, but we can have some cash flow interruptions for capital plans. If we're deferring SDCs over time, the repayment period is a 10-year period. So it's one thing to talk about, you know, one or two EDUs for a house or a duplex, which is, I think, really the intent of the policy when it was created, and not necessarily a 400 unit apartment complex where we're financing SDCs over a 10-year period. So that's the issue. We have clarified the policy in our rules that we're limiting financing SDCs for just to residential and multifamily developments that have 10 or fewer EDUs to address some of those issues and really tie more towards the issues that people are experiencing and connecting and having hardship for some of the costs to connect, where we can really provide that safety net. It aligns it more closely with our original intent. Greg, do you have a question?
Not a question. I was just going to ask Aaron to wait. So we've had a couple examples of this in the past, you know, while where we've had those larger scale projects take advantage of it, and we've not had good success. So Aaron, do you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. Yeah. Just basically, I think that was a good summary. We've had two developers who obtained financing for their projects over $100,000 in SDCs, and they haven't made any payments. So it isn't really our area of expertise to loan money out, but we do recognize the need to have a program to support customers who couldn't otherwise connect. And so this would just really kind of align with the intent, as Ron was sharing. We do have two other applications for this kind of financing that are out there. So we were really hoping this would already be approved, and these would be the new rules, but we are processing those applications under our current policy.
Oh, dear. Roseanne?
Thanks. I don't disagree with this policy. I agree. You guys are not, you know, in the business of financing like a bank. You know, you probably don't have all of the safety nets, you know, to ensure that money, you know, ends up getting paid, right? And you can collect on it. So I don't disagree with this policy. I wanted to bring up another element that's closely related, and I would argue that those developers that you're in the process of processing their application for financing would be just as happy, if not happier, with what's called system development charge deferral to a time anywhere closer to point of impact, right, on the system. I realize that that the backbone gets built ahead of time, but anywhere closer to the hookup or to the final inspection on residential homes or mixed use for that matter, but residential in particular, you know, the household isn't in there, you know, using the system. Realize the system's already in the ground, but in the spirit of what system development charges are, which is an impact fee, HBA would request that system development charge deferral to a point anywhere closer to the end of vertical construction be considered in the future. Thank you.
How about a certificate of occupancy?
Yeah, that's a good one. We've had cities, Gresham just recently adopted system development charge deferral for residential. They already had it for their commercial buildings, and they applied the same principle to residential at point of final inspection. Some other cities have done certificate of occupancy. I think Tigard did, I think, electrical inspection. And then Newburgh, I think, did either final inspection or certificate of occupancy. I think that, and I'll just be honest, the hang up that jurisdictions have with certificate of occupancy is that they feel like, you know, that's just all the days closer to a household moving van, you know, driving up to the house. And if the jurisdiction doesn't have their SDC paid, it's really hard to block, you know, a family from moving in and not issue that CFO, for example. I mean, maybe temp CFO could be a better option. I'm just thinking of how to come to some sort of a mutually agreeable point closer to the end of construction. And if that's final inspection, that's good with us.
All right, Greg DiLoretta.
Yeah, thank you. I think I sent Ron a note on this. And the one question I had was regarding the interest charged on these loans. If you look at what their the interest they charge is the prime rate charged on each principal payment. And yet, if we look at interest installments on something else, we charge the rate based on the last published Oregon State Treasurer's bond indices. I don't know which one's higher. But my point would be that we should not be losing money on this interest that we are on these loans that we're making. And so we should, I'm not understanding why there's two different rates on two type of installments, but more importantly, we need to be doing the one that makes sure that the money we loan doesn't cost us money because it's not earning interest where we had it invested before.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Greg, I flagged that in the comments that you provided, and thank you for reading the documents, by the way, and submitting comments. They're all
the whole thing.
That's awesome. I will circle back with Aaron and have that discussion on how we specify the interest. I don't want to put her on the spot right now to respond to that because I know she hates that. But I think the important part is we can circle back, and I'll get back to you on if we have a basis for. What interest we do actually charge, and then whether we should change that in the rule. William.
Thank you. I want to respond in a couple of points to Roseanne. I think first off, it sounds like there's really no objection to this proposed policy, other than Greg's comments about. The interest needs to be clarified, but the idea is helping people get into housing in these EDUs. The question that I have then is larger than the 10 EDUs. That's not clear to me that the deferral. I guess the point that I want to make is a deferral of SDCs, is that not the same as loaning the money by deferring it?
No, William, it's not the same because when you defer the time of point of collection, you're not sacrificing any actual money. You're just collecting it a few weeks later, probably a few months later from the time that they collect now. So they collect now when the building permit is issued, and we're proposing to collect the same payment several months later when final inspection, for example, is called in by the GC to be inspected. Now, you could make the argument that the money that didn't get paid in several months prior was somehow not being invested somewhere by West, but I can tell you for sure that that money collects carrying costs for the developer, the builder, to the tune of prime plus whatever, with a hard money lender or a conventional financer on the homes. And so that's going to be, I mean, that's ticking up now. It's like around 8%, and it's only going to go up now. 8% at the very minimum. And you talk hard money lending, you're 12, 13, 14, 15% annually. And then if it takes 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, you know, you just divide it into thirds, quarters, halves on each home, right? So we're talking like probably $2,000 to $5,000. I've done the calculations in different cities, but it's usually between $2,000 to $5,000 per home. So if you talk 100 lot subdivision, it adds up, you know, just those 4, 5, 6 months from original point of collection of the SCC to a revised point of collection. Does that make sense?
That makes sense from your perspective. I'm thinking from Wes's perspective, however, that's money that they don't have.
They will still receive the money though. And it is a policy decision. They will receive the money several
months.
Understood.
They will receive the money, but the idea is, I don't know that that's the best excuse as a strong argument for Home Builders Association is that they'll receive the money eventually. You know, we'll give it to them in 5 months, 6 months, maybe a year. We'll give you the money eventually, but we shouldn't have to pay any more because we have the advantage of not having to pay it when it was originally constructed.
So William, I'll chime in. I see Greg has his hand up. And I think the idea here is that, you know, we charge SDCs based on use and capacity.
Or expected use, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, until I appreciate the argument that, you know, you come in, you have plans for a home or a subdivision in this case, and you pay those fees up front, but you're clearly not using the capacity at that point. And so at what point is there a sweet spot between when you come in and say, I have these plans and I want them approved and I'm going to build this thing, and it actually comes online? And I think the difficulty is finding that sweet spot. Like certificate of occupancy has issues. And I'm sure Ron can and others can talk about why that might not work. You know, an electrical, you know, approval could be another avenue. There's a gray area between the time you come in and say, I'm going to build this, and the time you actually start using that capacity. And so the trick is, and I think what we haven't quite figured out is there a clear trigger or data point that we can use to then charge those SDCs. And so that's the challenge.
I would argue that it's when the plumbing permit is, or when the plumbing inspection is passed, because we know all the people that are building the house are using the facility. So it makes sense. Greg D has another question.
No, and unless we want to continue to debate this particular topic, I won't then. But I spent 40 years. This issue has been in front of agencies for 40 years because I've dealt with it for 40 years. And we've had this exact same conversation. And it is most difficult to collect those SDCs at any time other than a building permit issuance, not to mention the effect it has on the agency issuing that whatever you want to call it, certificate of occupancy, for which most of us don't even get one. I have a brand new house. I never got one. I'm sure one was done. So anyway, I don't know if that's going to be part of our conclusion to approve these rules. If it's not, then I would suggest we move on because we can be debating this for quite a long time.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I couldn't resist, had to bring it up. But no, it's not part of this specific policy. So I agree, we should move on.
Thank you. And certainly a conversation for a future rule update potentially. So I have three more in about 15 minutes, and I promised Lynn I would turn this over to her at 7:45. If we don't get there, we don't get there, but I think we've got a good shot at it. So can you go to the next slide, Lauren? I think that's where we are. Okay. So I'm going to touch on this one and let Roseanne have an opportunity if she chooses that. Because we've talked quite a bit with Roseanne about our proposal and our sanitary standards for sewer pipe slopes, where we currently right now have pipe slopes specified and will allow for shallower pipe slopes under certain circumstances. In our proposed policy, we're having a minimum pipe slope of 1% is proposed. And we provided a table that's supposed to be sort of an easier design guideline that for certain types of projects that have more connections would allow less than 1%, 0.75%, 0.5% with the more homes that are connected. That can create an issue. I think it's viewed as somewhat limiting, and particularly for some projects that have, for site constraints or one reason or another, some of these smaller developments that aren't in the 0.5% category may actually be able to meet our goals for self-cleaning and velocities in the sewer that at a shallower slope than what is specified in our table. Our solution is to add into the rules a provision that people can, it's an either or. They can either use the simplified table for selecting a pipe slope that we think will work, or they can show that they're meeting the guidelines in the Oregon State Sanitary Design Guidelines and OAR 340 Division 52, which is a calculation showing that we will get 2 feet per second of velocity in whatever pipe slope that is laid. That allows someone to really choose which approach if they do the work and certify that the design meets our requirements. And we also have had some discussions with Roseanne that variances are always possible as well for certain site-specific conditions. That gives the design engineer and the applicant the opportunity to make a case to us that they're not going to be building a system that is overly burdensome for the district to maintain. So with those three, I think we can still get what we need and be more flexible than how it was originally written. But Roseanne, I wanted to give you an opportunity to comment on this one before we move on.
I'm good. Thank you, Ron. I think that meeting the OARs, you know, that provides the additional flexibility for the development community. So thanks for the discussion on that.
Yeah, well, thank you. We're a lot of discussions, and I think you helped us get there. So Lauren, can you go to the next one? So this one's a little tricky as well. So for sanitary sewer connection ownership, we have the current policy that I have to say is somewhat unclear, but it specifies what portion of service connections, and they're also called laterals, that connect buildings to our mainline sewers. And we say that the lateral inside of the right-of-way or an easement is owned and operated by the district, and on the other side of that line is privately owned. That creates an issue for us, in part that what we would like to make more clear is that the district shouldn't be responsible for the maintenance or the operation of that line when it's typically the property owner or the building owner who are impacting that line, mostly from an operational standpoint, whether they're dumping something down there that shouldn't be dumped down there, they're disposing of wipes in the drain. Whatever creates that maintenance burden is really the user's issue. There are times when there's a structural defect in the line that needs to be repaired. And if it is on under our current policy on the right-of-way or easement side, that becomes Wes's responsibility to repair. we're proposing changing that responsibility more. That would be clearer that the district does not own and isn't responsible for the operation and routine maintenance of the line. And it does say currently that, you know, that we're not responsible for repairing and replacing without really being specific about where that repair might take place. We've heard, we understand, and I think we've heard from both Greg DiLoretto and Christopher Bowker that there's a concern about some potentially very expensive repairs under streets and sidewalks and in places that aren't really suitable for a homeowner to take on a project. And I think our intent and what we do today in practice is actually to, for the district, at the district's discretion, to participate in those repairs under those circumstances. And so what I've reached out to both Greg and Christopher and said, we, you know, certainly can add clarifying language to make that clear, that there is certainly an option at the district's discretion to help in those circumstances. And that may potentially alleviate some of that concern, but I wanted to give them an opportunity to weigh in. Either one. Do you want me to pick one, Diane?
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Okay.
I think Greg had his hand up first.
Well, thanks, Ron. And, you know, we've been talking all evening, and I haven't gotten to say thank you for doing all this, because as somebody who's had experience with a couple of agencies that did it, this is a lot of work, and there is about 1,000 pages, and I did read it all, although over a bit of time, because your mind will start to wander. It is a lot, and you've done a lot, and so I don't think anyone really, I hope everyone appreciates how much it takes to put one of these together and the work you folks have done. And frankly, out of all those 1,000 pages, this was the only policy area that I had a concern about, that I thought the committee ought to talk about it, because it does change what most of us as customers think of when we think of our water and sewer system. We are, most of us, used to the fact that the agency owns the line. Everything within the right-of-way belongs to the agency. Everything out of the right-of-way belongs to the homeowner. And so all of a sudden, this comes along, and of course, that's quite a surprise to those of us who have never thought that way. And in fact, if you look at the rule, it does need some at least major work for me to be comfortable with it, because it says in the rule, it says the property owner that benefits from the service connection is solely financially responsible for the repair, replacement pipeline from the building sewer to and including to the main. And the fact of the matter is, that's a huge burden. If the county comes along, wants to rebuild a road, and now they're going to replace the sewer line and laterals, guess what? You're going to get to pay for that. Not kind of unlike West Lynn having to pay for our water line across the bridge when we weren't planning on it. But in this case, it's quite a bit of money, and you don't have any choice. The way you do currently, you do it, although it kind of conflicts with your rules, it says that you will pay, or you may consider paying, if there's a structural defect. And I can't really accept that, because if the pipe breaks in the right of way, you know, heavy trucks, freeze thaw conditions, whatever, that isn't really the property owner's concern. I'm also concerned about the mark that will give on West in terms of customer service. You know, they're just not going to, our customers aren't going to be too happy with us. All the goodwill we've built up will go away, all because, you know, we've made this one change. I do agree that if you're flushing junk down the toilet that you shouldn't be, or down the drain, that is your responsibility. I mean, the rest of us in our community didn't flush those wipes down or let oil and grease build up, so that is yours. And so I think we need to clarify that, but it makes me less comfortable saying that I, as a customer, and that's really how I'm looking at it, if I was the customer, that I own that sewer line all the way to the main, and yet I can't go out in the street and dig it up. I'd have to get a contractor if you could find one. I got to put base course back in. I got to put the pipe back in. I got to pave it. And I know these things because I'm an engineer, but imagine people that don't even know these things. It's just, I think, overwhelming, and I don't think it helps us. I think we need to get at what your real issue is, which are blockages and things that we do as customers to harm that sewer lateral. Yes, we need to be responsible for that. So those were my comments. Thank you.
Okay. Christopher.
Well, that's a hard act to follow. Greg was much more eloquent than I will be. But I did just want to go kind of on the record and just say I did have some concerns with this. And I know in my experience that
the risk that you're asking the homeowner to take on, the additional risk, it is a pretty large cost. And I know in my particular instance, I think from the curb, from the right of way to the main line, for me, it was around $7,000 of added cost. So I appreciate Wes's desire to reduce risk to them and the agency. I do understand that, but this really would be in that process pushing off a huge risk onto the homeowner. And so I won't necessarily rehash all the points that Greg just made, but they're all very good points to be considering and that hopefully you do consider. And I also wonder, I might be more supportive of this change. I wonder if there's some sort of compromise in terms of being able to help the homeowner meet those costs. And I know Aaron sort of hit the nail on the head earlier when saying that Wes is not in the business of providing loans. And I do appreciate that. But I wonder perhaps there's if you were to move forward with this policy change, maybe there's some sort of collaboration with a local credit union where there's some sort of accelerated or streamlined loan process so that when a homeowner does need to do a lateral improvement or for some reason that they need to replace their lateral, that there's some existing program maybe that they could easily apply and qualify for some sort of amount, which could be like $10,000 or more, 10 to 15, maybe even $20,000 to do that lateral repair. And then another point, I know in my experience, it might be in the rules that Greg spoke to, but just clarifying like the why. Is the why a part of the main? Is that a part of the lateral? Whose responsibility is that? That's that Y-shaped connection right at the sewer main. So just being crystal clear with that and just being really cognizant that reducing risk to Wes will cost the homeowner a lot more money.
Good point.
I appreciate Ron, your response, the pamphlet that you sent. I do appreciate that. That was very helpful.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for your input. Anthony.
There we go. Good evening, everybody. So I work with the Oregon Drinking Water Program. We regulate drinking water systems, and I'm just a member from Milwaukee. I'm not representing the drinking water program here, but with the way that we do our work, water systems are responsible from the source of the water all the way out to the point of delivery, which is always the property line or the service meter. Obviously, that's a little different than we do with sewerage. But the concern that I have here is if the right-of-way is part of the property owner's responsibility, they own this parcel of land and part of it is a right-of-way, requiring the homeowner to, you know, manage the expenses for that repair, that makes sense to me. But if it's going to extend the responsibility out past where their property line ends and they lose control over the actual, like we've mentioned a couple times, going into the street, that sort of thing. That's not something as a private citizen I can just do on my own. I can't just go out and start excavating. And I know that point's been made, but I would be completely comfortable with requiring the property owner to manage their service connection, at least for the property that they're actually responsible for, but requiring them to take on that expense and you know, the rest of that hassle for a property that they do not own, get no material benefit from, et cetera, I'm really having a hard time with. I recognize Wes's responsibilities and I don't want to add more to the expenses. I'm all about trying to save some money too, but shifting that responsibility over to the homeowners when, you know, they don't have an option and they don't really even control the piping past their own property line seems a little egregious to me.
Okay.
I agree. Yep.
Thank you for that. Greg Geis, do you have a comment?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a 50-50 kind of thing. I mean, there's many people who are entities who do this and some that don't. That's why we brought it to you. And I think what we're hearing is we don't have support for it. Our current policy is to go to the right of way and then we take over from there. And so to me, I'm hearing enough to say that that's what we want to continue to do. So that's fine. That's why we have these conversations.
But we also need to address if there are homeowners who are abusing their system, what are the consequences to that? And maybe that is another portion of this, that if we have to go in to the right of way and fix the result of what they've been doing, here's what this will cost you. That needs to be addressed, I think.
Yeah, and I think our options, we can forego this one, or we can continue to work on it. I think there are ways for us to pull back a bit from completely assigning the responsibility to the homeowner and do more of what's being discussed, which is clarifying the intent of the rules to identify the responsible party for operation and maintenance of a service connection, and be more specific about exactly when the district will participate in the repair of structural defects. That's something that we can certainly work on the language as we go forward over the next several months, likely 6 months, and I and Greg and others can commit to making that change in the rules in light of this concern, if people are comfortable with that. Anthony, do you have another comment or question?
So yes, I wanted to clarify my comments. Speaking to defects and that sort of thing, where it's outside of the homeowner's concern and it's off their property line, I stand by my comments. But if, you know, we identify an issue, they do some excavation and they determine that it's not a defect, it's not a drainage, it's misbehavior, drop the hammer. I'm fine with the homeowner owning that. If it's their responsibility, you know, that's perfectly fine. The real concern I have is, you know, like you mentioned, if there's freeze and thaw, or, you know, heavy trucks or whatever driving through an area that I don't have a lot of control over and it breaks my sewer line, I feel like I'm getting shafted more than once there, and that's not fair. But if it's all me doing something, then yeah, I should bear the brunt of all of that.
Okay. Thank you. I don't know how much more you have, Ron, but we're already past your time period here, and we've already cut back on Lynn's time. So this definitely needs more discussion, and I think we'll fine tune it over the next month or so and bring it back to the team once I need to see maybe a couple of examples of things that have happened that where we've had to go in and do this, and maybe to help kind of enlighten us if we want to take it to a new level.
Okay. Well, I had one more policy I was going to discuss. I guess I'll ask Diana and Greg, our options are, we can wrap up now and come back in March and continue the conversation, or finish with the last policy and entertain the motion.
Greg, I would need the advisory committee's approval to go over the meeting probably 15 minutes.
Let's get it done.
And allow Lynn to get her time in as well. Are you guys okay with that?
Okay, but I don't know that we're ready for a motion tonight. We had some things that I think we need to see, don't you, before we do a motion on it? Or am I the only?
Well, I think just to characterize, we're asking for the committee to concur with the policies as proposed or modified, and then, but again, not approve the rules and standards as written. That's a much later process when we go through for the adoption hearings. But we have to finalize the words and the documents before we can do that, and before we can engage the board. And so I understand if we need to revisit a handful of the policies that we've talked about tonight with new proposed language before we can get that concurrence, then I totally understand. Otherwise, if we're comfortable enough to say, yeah, these make sense as modified, then move forward with the process.
I would want to see the modified language before I could make a motion on that.
Okay.
I think there's a couple that need some bigger modifications.
We don't have to go through the whole thing, but just these ones we've talked
about
tonight.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. Right, right.
Yeah, and we can clarify that. There's just my brief notes, like the annexation piece, clarifying intents, the interest piece that Greg brought up, and the pipe in the right-of-way.
Right.
I think we need to bring those back. I do think that Ron, Ron is kind of, you know, synthesized the main issues. So I'd like to get the last one done so that we can come back next time and have these, you know, from 13 to 6 to hopefully 3 or 4.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's
do it. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay. Lauren, can you go to the 2 slides down? Well, actually, just 1 slide down. Well, no, keep going. Sorry. I'll tell you when to stop. This one for a second. You can go back to the last one. So there's a picture. We said this last time. Keep this in your mind. This is a stormwater facility that is almost entirely walled. The walls in the background are greater than 14 feet in height. The rest of the walls are greater than 7 feet in height. This is an extremely challenging situation for the district to maintain these facilities. Next slide. So the issue is that, as I just said, they're challenging to maintain. We don't have any restrictions on the use of walls or slopes steeper than 3:1, which is what we're generally after in our stormwater standards. We're proposing adding some restrictions to the overall, the maximum height of walls, as well as the amount of the perimeter of the facility that can be walled over a certain height. We have benchmarked other jurisdictions in crafting this. This is a little different than what we see typically from other jurisdictions. I will say, sort of broadly speaking, most people just limit the amount of a facility that can be walled or steeper than a 3:1 slope to 25% to 30% of the perimeter of the facility. What we're proposing is we will allow more of the facility to be walled than most other jurisdictions, but to put some restrictions on those heights based on maintainability. We did a look back. I've had several conversations with Roseanne about this one again, and we'll ask her for input in a second. But we've looked back at I don't know, roughly 10 subdivisions over the last 5 years or so that have had have built large stormwater facilities, and would say probably 2 or 3 of them would not meet this requirement and wouldn't be built like they were built, including the picture, the one that's in the picture that we just showed, which is a good thing from our perspective, that wouldn't be allowed under the proposed rule. But it's certainly the more we restrict how much a stormwater facility can be walled, the more land that gets consumed to build the stormwater facility in the absence of any other adjustments. We've talked a little bit about setbacks from the top of walls and ways to mitigate maintainability. But right now we're sort of at an impasse with the stormwater facility walls requirements. So wanted to bring that to the advisory committee for a brief discussion. Roseanne, do you have any additional input on this issue?
I think we're just waiting to see kind of how the 10-foot height limit was defined, kind of like what's ground zero, if you will.
Right. Yeah. And that is to the base of the wall, essentially where the wall meets the ground or the pond, not to the bottom of the pond, which would be another bunch of feet.
Right. Okay. So have you guys experienced like different grading techniques for kind of making sure that, you know, the wall blocks are adequately, you know, staged in height? If they're, you know, slightly above 10 feet, can there be some adjustments made there for like around with the grading and stuff?
Yeah, I think as we talked about, there is a, you know, if we stick with the 10 feet, and it's, like I said, 14 is too much, 10, it's not arbitrary, but it seems to be a workable amount that there is always a variance process. So if somebody does come to us and say, look, we need to have a 14-foot wall for a shorter run of the perimeter of the facility, then that would be within the district's discretion to entertain those design modifications, as long as the applicant can clearly show that maintenance access won't be prohibitively challenging.
Yeah. So, I mean, just for the group, I know this one's probably going to move forward, and I actually, you know, had the development community that, that I represent, you know, was not fully on board with this, but I think acknowledge that, you know, it's kind of a nerdy topic, right? Nobody's going to understand, the layperson doesn't understand that, hey, the more or less wall you have, the more or less land gets taken up. They just see the end product and know that the, maybe they know the water is being infiltrated. so I guess, you know, happy to move forward, but also want to flag it as a recognition of the trade-offs, right, of our land use system, that more land will be taken up. Because it's a priority for West to be able to have assurance that they can maintain and clean and have access to the detention pond and the wall, all the wall area.
Yeah, as we discussed, we agreed to revisit the language and clearly identify those off ramps so that it's predictable if it's needed.
Right. Thank you.
William.
Briefly, I'm supportive of this in principle because we need to have access to those facilities. I'm concerned about the wording, and I know that you're going to work on that, where it says facilities are often difficult. Often means more than just usual. And currently no standards for private facilities. There's no verb there. But this isn't the rule. These are just the words. And I want something about minimums and maximums instead of just limited to the height of.
Okay.
And up to 50%. The way this is worded, it looks like it has to be 50% of the facility, this the circumference. So I just think the wording needs to be a little more crisp.
All right. We will revisit that. Okay. Well, I think that was what I really wanted to flag tonight based on people's input. So. And we'll forego the motion and come back in March with a handful of more topics.
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
I feel the same way.
All right. All right. And we're actually going to push Lynn's, I'm sorry, Lynn, we're going to push you out till March as well. These were big topics, and I think trying to squeeze in another tonight might be a little too much. So Lynn's is an ongoing discussion anyway, but it is also going to need a motion for support, and we may have some hangups as far as questions there too. So Ron, thank you for your presentation, and thank you everyone for weighing in. These are extremely important topics as we're going through this 1,000-page document, and we want to make sure we get it right. Although it can be changed, the iterations can move forward. But Greg, yes.
I just want to say thank you for your patience.
Oh, one more hand, William.
Stop. I don't know how to shut the thing off. I'll hang up. Goodbye. That was my reminder for another project. Sorry.
Okay.
I was just going to say, like, we had a lot of meaty things on the agenda, and it's a feast or famine kind of thing. And yeah, I think we got through a lot, and I really appreciate that. And we'll come back with the other things, and it's not catastrophic. It doesn't affect our budgetary process. So things will also be kind of intense next time in March and in May as we start talking about budget. So I hope that it feels like we really zeroed in on a few critical things, and I appreciate that. So.
All right. And I do want to bring up one quick thing before we sign off tonight. Shelley Perini and her team put together the 2022 to 2025 communication and engagement roadmap. I got to see a preview of this just recently, and she'll be sending this out to the advisory committee, but I just want to say it's a fabulous document, and I wanted to give her time to go over it tonight, but we don't have time. I'm hoping in March or May we can go over this and get your input on it as well. So that's just another big thing. I said to somebody earlier today, I think we're going to have to go to monthly meetings to get everything covered, because there's so many things that we're trying to do in an every other month format. Yeah. So does anyone have anything else for the good of the order?
No, I would just say that we're trying for 2-hour meetings next year. So hopefully that will help.
All right. I would
be in favor of monthly meetings instead of every other month. I think as you look at these agendas, it was going to be extremely difficult to get through a 2-hour meeting with everything that was on this agenda. So I completely support switching to once a month.
That might be tough for a lot of for the electeds and those serving on other committees, but we can certainly look at it, and Lauren can probably send out a poll to see if that's a possibility or not. It might possibly shorten the meetings, which would be kind of nice too. So it's a long time to sit for some of us.
I'd be in favor of that.
Oh, good. All
right. Having said so much, I've been listening the whole time.
Thank you, Martha.
Okay. All right.
Anyone else?
I just want to say thank you. This is why we do this. This was a meaty agenda, and we got through part of it, and that's great, and I appreciate it. I'm so gratified at the level of engagement we have and the level of expertise we have. This truly, like, charts our course, and that's what you're for. And I thank you for doing that.
And thank you, everyone, for attending tonight. And we'll see you in March. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Cheers. Cheers.